Hydrogen atoms with one electron, sometimes will allow static helium atom, two electrons. It's already complicated enough. And very often it happens that we make very, very crude approximations, and basically we are trying to describe very simple. However, if we look outside, life is much more complicated than one electron hydrogen atom, and it's not possible, hardly possible, to describe a complicated system exactly. Nevertheless, for many years, we developed different methods in statistical physics, mainly to work in solid-state physics, and now for the last, I would say, decade, there's an attempt to use those kinds of methods. Let's say they are basically a probability theory and also statistical physics to many different problems, which basically before, let's say 20 years ago, we wouldn't even think that they could be treated with a physical means. For instance, one can try to apply such methods describing phenomena, let's say, in biology, in econophysics, in seismic studies, and so on. And therefore, our aim of this series is to give you some flavor, what is the complexity and the methods. And today we start with the first talk, which is going to be delivered by Maya. You know, all of you know Maya Kaczewski. She is also a long-term visitor here at Perimeter. She has a position at Imperial College in London, and for many years she just worked in this field. She worked in many different, let's say, subfields like econophysics, like theory of earth science, seismic behaviors, also I think she contributed a lot to, let's say, applications of physics in biology. And today she will tell us about self-organized mechanics.
Good afternoon. So, today's talk is just a basic overview of a topic called the self-organized criticality that has been a lively topic in the scientific literature for the last 20 years, and sort of falls within the, where's the stick, by the way? Falls within the general category of complex systems studies. And when you say that you study complex systems, quite often the first question you get asked is, what is complexity, which is a perfectly rational question, actually. Peter Grassberger will be talking about, let's say, definitions of complexity in the next talk. I'm going to take a really very pedestrian view. Actually, I think that in complex systems, we sort of confront our conceptual problems right at the very beginning, whereas in other fields, like in foundations of quantum theory or in gravity, you have to do some work before you really confront your big problems. So I'm going to just bypass any kind of formal definition of complex systems and take a very pedestrian view. So we want to describe many natural systems that have certain types of properties. And one property which is very important is that they are out of equilibrium. And another property is that if you look at them at different scales, you see different features. And so you get what is called emergence. Somehow we have life which emerges out of chemistry, or we have seismicity, which emerges out of a kind of slow turbulence of the tectonic plate motion. And in fact, when we look at various different systems, which I'll give you some examples of empirical observations, we see the same sorts of patterns in many different sorts of systems, not just physical systems, but also biological systems and social systems. And this is sort of, recognition of patterns has statistical patterns, so scaling laws and so on, has sort of motivated people to think in terms of a very simple dynamical models to try to describe these phenomena and capture these statistical patterns. A particularly good example is the body of work that has been done in the context of self-organized criticality, and that is what I'm going to talk about today. But first, I want to just, for those of you who don't know what a critical system is, I want to just very briefly explain it. So in this context, it comes from studying phase transitions in equilibrium systems. So let's say you have a piece of iron, and it's a magnet, and at low temperatures, it's magnetized, so you can pick up other magnetized, other magnetic things with it. So there's a net magnetic moment, there's a net magnetization at low temperatures. But if you heat this magnet up, before it melts, the magnetization goes away. So right at the Curie temperature is the point where the magnetization vanishes. And if you look at it, if you place the magnet in a magnetic field, so you have the magnetic field and the temperature. If you vary the magnetic field and you cross at low temperature, you will flip the magnetization from a negative value to a positive value. But right at this point where the magnetic field is zero, we have this critical point. And this critical point, or second order phase transition, has the property that there it has diverging length scales. And there are scaling laws, or which can be described with field theories, which describe the statistical features at the critical point. So I'll give you just a very specific example. Let's say you have an icing model. So an icing model is just a set of spins that can point up or down. And let's say you put it in two dimensions. So here's a configuration of icing spins pointing up or down. And they interact with their nearest neighbor such that there's a tendency, there's a favorable energy if the nearest neighbor's points in the same direction, and an unfavorable energy if they point in opposite directions. Now, at low temperatures, because of the energy, then the spins will want to be aligned, and you get magnetism, because all of the spins, almost at very low temperatures, almost all the spins will be pointing in the same direction. But if you heat the system up, entropy becomes more important, and you will start to flip spins. So you'll be able to overcome the energy barrier. And that's why at high temperatures, the system gets disordered, and the magnetization goes to zero. But if you're sitting right at the critical point, so here's a result from a numerical simulation of a finite system at the critical point. I think the blue regions are spin up and the green regions are spin down. You get clusters of magnetized regions of all different sizes. So what you have then, whereas at very low temperatures, you would have, let's say, everything be blue and just a few green spots. As you increase the temperature, the green regions get bigger, and if you measure the sizes of these clusters that you get in fact a scale-free distribution. So what happens as you go to the critical point is that the correlation length, C, diverges. And associated with that critical point, you have a fractal structure, and you also have long-time correlations in the magnetization. And this is what we mean by criticality. Now, in the case of equilibrium systems, where you see this in many different systems, but again, only at isolated points, this is because you have to fine-tune many different parameters in order to observe this scaling behavior. Okay. So you might think that it's not something that one would generally see. This kind of critical behavior is not something that one would generally see in nature, because this requires a very fine experimental situation where you get exactly to that point in order to see these kinds of fluctuations. But if you just go out and start measuring natural signals, time series for instance, you see long time correlations and long range spatial correlations in many different systems. So here's an example of emission from a quasar. This is a time series of it. And you have, in fact, you have bumps at all different scales. Now, if you take the Fourier, if you take the power spectrum of this signal, so now you plot the log of the power versus the log of the frequency, you get not white noise, which would be smooth, a curve here with no slope, but you get evidence you have more and more power at lower and lower frequencies. You have a kind of 1 over F behavior. And this is something that indicates that the system is in some kind of critical state, this anomalous power law that you see here. And there have been many theories that have been proposed, let's say, to try to understand why you see 1 over F noise, not just in quasars, you see it in all sorts of different systems. And in fact, if you just look at systems that we can just see here on Earth. For instance, HERST, so this is systems which are very far away. Let's say it's maybe difficult to make models for it. So we just get more down to Earth. If we look at, for instance, time series of the river, of levels of the River Nile, this was analyzed by HERST roughly about 100 years ago. And he also found one over effluents for the water levels in the River Nile. So these are some things, these are things that we can go and look in great detail at. So this is a picture of the Brahmaputra Ganges River in India and Bangladesh. And it has, if you look at the fluctuations in water flow, it's got this kind of 1/F spectrum. And it also has got a spatial scaling behavior, a kind of invariance under a change of scales. So that if you took, let's say, this part here and blew it up, so it fit the whole region here, the statistics of the structures that you saw would be rather similar. That is, it has a kind of fractal property. And you can actually, in, let's say, very simple geometric models, construct curves or sets of points that have non-trivial fractal dimension. So here is a famous example of a Koch curve. This is constructed just by, let's say, starting out with a shape like this, and then taking each segment and breaking it up into four pieces, as shown here, which are 1/3 the length. And then for each piece here, you do the same thing as you did to go from here to there. And you carry this on forever. And then you want to measure what is the dimension of the curve that you finally end up with if you repeat this process over and over again. And there's a very simple argument to get what its dimension would be. Now, if it was just a straight line, then its dimension would be 1. If it was just a uniform surface, the dimension would be 2. But because you've got more and more structure at ever finer and finer scales, even though this thing is just constructed out of line segments, it has a dimension larger than 1. And you can compute the dimension just by counting how many more line segments do you get when you reduce the scale by a certain factor. So here, when we reduce the scale by factor 3 in going from here to there, we increase the number of line segments by 4, factor 4, and this gives us, from this relation, what the dimension is. And it's actually completely trivial to calculate what the dimension is in this case. So that's just a proof, let's say, that you can get non-integer dimensions. And people have taken this sort of satellite data and gone and analyze what the dimensions of these structures are, and they get non-trivial dimensions. So the idea is that maybe the fluctuations that you see in time, if you look at the river flowing, at the water levels in this sort of system, are related to its non-trivial fractal geometry in space. So there's a connection between time and space. Now, how could that connection come about? Well, if you actually look at how the morphology of rivers change. Well, there's different types of rivers. So the river that I showed you before is a braided river. It doesn't really matter. What you get are, you get a sort of catastrophic collapses of river banks, or sort of avalanches of change that happen very quickly. Like, you know, a minute before, let's say, this picture was taken, this river bank was perfectly stable. And while these people were standing here, suddenly the whole thing collapsed. So it's pretty clear that the geometry of these rivers is being determined by these sort of avalanches of collapses of the riverbank. So there's a connection now between the geometry and this kind of avalanche dynamics. And in fact, people have gone and studied the statistics of how often do you have an avalanche of a certain size in these sorts of systems? And if you plot the log of the number of failures of a certain size versus the size, you get approximately a power law distribution. In any case, there is no clear characteristic size for the collapses of these things. So, and this is actually a generic feature in many different sorts of systems that have the fractal geometry and the long-time correlations, that they also exhibit collapses or avalanches which have at least approximately a power law distribution of sizes. So now, using that as an example, what we can say is that for many complex systems, what we have in common is that they are far from equilibrium. There are some thresholds. In this case, it was some critical slope or instability associated with the edge of the river. If it gets above a certain thing, then the whole thing will just collapse. You observe intermittent or sporadic avalanches which have broad distributions. And these avalanches change the structure, which emerges then in a fractal way. And this structure, of course, in turn will change the pattern of the avalanches. So this feedback between the avalanches and the structures gives you a dynamics that has correlations over long time scales. And this could, in fact, be the origin, perhaps, of this 1/f noise. So there are many other examples in nature that exhibit this kind of phenomenology, and that have been discussed a lot in the literature. Just to give you a very brief idea of the breadth of the subject, it has been noted, for instance, that if you look at evolution, so you know that there have been instances in time where we had very big extinction events, and then there have been very quiet periods in the history where there weren't very many extinction events. So in fact, if you look over geological time, so this is time in millions of years going back from the present, and this axis is the percent of marine genera, that went extinct in a given time interval, which I think is 5 million years, you see that you get enormous large fluctuations in this. So these extinction events can also be looked at as avalanches, and in fact appear to have no characteristic scale as well. Another scaling law that you see if you look at biological evolution on the long time scale is that you can measure, for instance, how long has a species that was created, okay, roughly 99% of all species that were ever created are now extinct. So you can go and measure more or less how long did they live on Earth. Okay, some species were around for a long time, some species were not around very long. And again, if you look at the distribution of the lifetime of genera, you get approximately a power law distribution, or at least a very broad distribution. And again, there is no characteristic time that sets the scale for how long a species should exist. And a third feature is that even if you look at individual species, so this kind of analysis and this kind of analysis come from statistics of aggregating many different species together, but even if you look at the particular history of a single species, so this is, for instance, the mean thoracic width of this creature, Pseudocubus hema. So that's like which has been studied. What you see is that it is stable for a while, some feature of that species, and then it jumps and is stable for a while, and then it jumps and is stable for a while. And this is a property called punctuated equilibrium that was noted by Gould and Eldridge. And in fact, if you look across different species, all their changes will tend to happen at the same time. So species don't change smoothly, they change in this intermittent way. And lots of species will change their properties at the same time. And this suggests, all of this suggests, that evolution is another one of these avalanching processes where one species' extinction creates a cascade that leads to other species going extinct. And in fact, all of these sorts of statistical properties can in fact be explained with very simple models. And that has been also a subject of great interest, but I won't talk about that here. Another example where you see this type of phenomenology is if you just look at the sun. If you look at the magnetic fields On the corona, you get a fractal structure for the magnetic fields coming out of the corona. If you look at the distribution of flare energies, which are these bursts of emissions of X-ray radiation that come from the photosphere, if you look at this on a log-log scale, you get a power log distribution. And if you look at time series of emission from the sun, you get correlations between these bursts in time. And this gives you, again, a 1 over F noise. So I could also, of course, discuss earthquakes, which have a very similar phenomenology. But I think I'll just go on now. So how do you approach these sorts of problems? You have these very messy, in principle, very messy systems. If you want to make a model of a riverbank, you can't really think you're going to solve the equations of soil mechanics at some sort of microscopic level and get out sort of the fractal structure, the 1 over F noise, the mud bank slides. At least that seems to be a very remote possibility now. But that doesn't mean that you can't say anything about it. Maybe you can describe the statistical features, certain statistical features, with, let's say, very simple models, because you see scaling behavior, or at least approximate scaling behavior. And we know from our studies in equilibrium system that if you have scaling, this tends to support the notion of universality. And what that means is that many different systems will have the same scaling behavior, because a lot of microscopic degrees of freedom, almost all microscopic degrees of freedom, become irrelevant when you look at much larger scales. So this notion of universality suggests that there could be very simple models that describe these sorts of statistical features. So the starting point of all of this was a paper in 1987 by Bachtan and Wiesenfeld, and they proposed the paradigm of self-organized criticality as an explanation for all the occurrence of the phenomena that I just talked about in all these sorts of different systems. This is a way of thinking about these problems and a guiding point for constructing models for them. So the paradigm then is just this sampler, which is shown here. So let me just briefly explain what this means. So let's say you have this table here, and you start adding sand. So when you first add sand, so the sand falls and it just stays on the table. Nothing happens. But eventually you build up a little pile. And then if you add a sand grain, one sand grain hits the pile, and it may dislodge the sand grain on the pile, which then starts flowing down the pile. And those rolling grains may further dislodge other grains, and you get an avalanche over the pile of sand grains rolling down. And as a result of this kind of dynamics, the pile will develop into a marginally stable slope, such that the addition of one grain of sand can trigger an arbitrarily sized collapse over the entire pile. It doesn't mean, of course, that you always have these catastrophic avalanches, because then obviously the whole slope would go down. But what it means is that you cannot predict, for instance, how big the avalanche will be, that the information of the whole structure is communicated through correlations in it. So you can have avalanches of all sizes. So what you find in this situation of the slow addition of sand and the system building up to this marginally stable state is that you can observe these avalanches with a power law distribution. The pile itself, if you look at fluctuations of the slope of the pile, will have correlations over space. So these fluctuations will be spatially correlated. It won't be a completely smooth pile, but it will have ripples in it. And you will also have correlations in time, such as 1 over F noise, if you look at the flow out from the pile, like how does the sand fall off the table, that sort of thing. And you see that this is a dynamical mechanism. So you don't have to tune parameters like you do in equilibrium systems. You don't have to set the temperature of the IC model equal to TC in order to observe the scaling behavior. The system does it all by itself through a dynamical process. And that is the real key feature, because that's the self-organized part of it, is this dynamics of the attractor of the system. The dynamics forces the system into this what would seem to be very improbable state, but if we look in nature, seems to reflect what we actually see. So in this case, you can see that there are fundamental parameters. For instance, the fundamental parameter for a sand pile is its slope. And this parameter is an emergent property of the pile with avalanches. So that's sort of the metaphorical picture. And now I'll tell you about the first model of self-organized criticality, a very simple mathematical model. So this is the Abelia or BTW sand pile. So you have an L by L lattice. Let's say we're in two dimensions. You can do it in three or whatever. And at each site on the lattice, you have an integer z. So at each site I, you have an integer z sub I. So this is not now real sand grains. These are, let's say, physicists, mathematical sand grains. So they're going to have, let's say, you might think slightly unphysical laws for describing a real sand pile. I'll get to applications of this model later. But let's just take this as a starting point. So the way the system then is going to be driven is that we're going to pick a site at random and add a sand grain. So what that means is that when we add sand at a site I, its variable z is increased by 1. That's it. Okay? Now, from what I've told you, we need to incorporate an instability, a way of starting avalanches. So we're going to, and that seems to be a very fundamental feature of these systems, is that they've got these nonlinear, very strong instabilities that where things start happening, whereas slightly below that, nothing would happen. So the instability criteria here is that if the z at any site I is bigger than 3, that means if it's 4, 5, 6, 7, we say that the site topples. That's the lingo that's used. And what that means is that its z value gets decreased by 4. And in addition, the z values of each of its neighbors is increased by 1. So you subtract 4 from that site, and you add 1 to each of its 4 neighbors. So this conserves z. And now, of course, one of those neighbors could have had a height 3. So if you added a grain to it, then it would, of course, become unstable. And it would then also have to topple. And so you just keep doing this over and over again until the system has settled with all z's less than or equal to 3. And then you just start. That means that the pile is stable. And then you can just add another grain and start and keep going like that. So this is the idea here is that you're adding these sand grains very slowly. So during an avalanche, you never add a grain. But that's not so essential. So if you look at what happens from numerical simulations.
What happens at the edge? Do they just fall off the edge?
Yeah, right. That's a very important point. Thanks for mentioning that. So you can see that you get into a problem if, well, the way that I've explained it, if you have periodic boundary conditions, because eventually the thing will never stop, mm-hmm. right? Okay, so it depends on what you want to study. For the purposes of comparing, let's say, with a sand pile, okay, you need to be able to get rid of the sand. And so the boundary conditions here are open. So if one of the sites at the edge topples, it will throw 1 grain to each of its neighbors, and 1, which will be 3, let's say, and 1 grain will just get thrown out of the system, okay? So actually, Peter Grassberger has this famous, I guess it's famous, analogy of the BTW model, which you might appreciate if you've ever had to deal with a bureaucracy. But in that analogy, what you have is you have an office full of secretaries or bureaucrats, and they're arrayed on a lattice. And you go in and you give one of them a paper that they have to deal with. And of course, they don't do anything unless they have 4 or more papers, in which case they give 1 paper to each of their neighbors. And that's what happens, except for the guys at the edge of the room who just throw 1 paper out the window. Yeah. So that's the model. Okay. So now, it doesn't matter what initial condition you start with. You can start with an empty system. You can start with a supercritical system. You can start with any system that you want to start with. If you just keep doing this over and over again, relaxing the system so everything is stable and add a grain, eventually you'll get into a stationary state. This can be proven mathematically. I'll discuss that briefly in a minute. And if you look then in that stationary state, and you look at the avalanches that you have, so sometimes, of course, when you add a grain, you might add that grain to a site that had z equals 0, and then nothing would happen, right? You would just increase its z value to 1, and then there would be no avalanche. So then you just pick another site and add a grain. But eventually, of course, you will hit a site with z equal to 3, and you'll start an avalanche. And these avalanches can be big or small. So this is an example of a relatively small avalanche, and this is an example of a relatively big avalanche that spans the whole system. Yeah.
So when you have when a site triggers an avalanche, if that site topples and the next site topples, does the next site also distribute something back?
Of course it does. Yeah. It's a whole right.
But that could end,
that means it could topple again.
You could just have
right. Yeah, I'm going to get to that. That's a very interesting point. If you're just patient for 2 minutes or 5 minutes, I will talk about that in detail. You're absolutely right. In this case, it can definitely go back, and the site can get re-triggered and topple again. Okay, and that's of course how you can get these very big avalanches. Okay, so, and I want to just say that in this particular model has got this abelian property, which I'll discuss a little bit later, which is what has really intrigued theorists about this model, led people to believe that it could be solved. Some aspects of the formula can be solved, but the avalanche statistics haven't been solved for yet. So maybe some very bright student here can solve this model. But the important point is that the order of toplings doesn't change the final state that you arrive at. I'll discuss that again later. So that was the point that was just raised is very important. So let's see let's say we think about the site where we added the grain. So, and it toppled. So that meant it had a z equal to 3, and when we added the grain, it became z equal 4, okay? And it then went down to 0, and it distributed one grain to, yeah?
I just want to make sure I understand this abelian property.
You're
saying that it's in the course of the avalanche, say, several sites get over 4, then you have to pick one to do next.
It doesn't matter which
one you
right. You'll get the same final state. I'll discuss that when I get to the mathematical part. Okay.
So
I'm going to come back to that.
Consistency condition that the avalanche is well defined.
Most of the models are not abelian. Okay, that people discuss.
Then you pick it right to the next one.
No, you do a parallel update. So you take all. In principle, you can get different behaviors depending on your dynamical procedure for describing avalanches. Okay. So in this particular case, it doesn't matter how you do it, but this is not a generic property. I just mentioned that it has this, let's say, special feature, which has led people to operator algebra construction for the model, and I'll get to that, okay? So it has some kind of, let's say, pure theoretical interest as well. So let's go back now to the site where we added the grain. So it had z equal to 3, and now it's going to topple, so now we add one grain, it has z equal to 4. When we topple, its z goes to 0, and each of its neighbors gets one grain. Now, it's pretty easy to see that the only way that site where we added the grain can ever topple again is if each of its neighbors topples, because then it can only get sand grains from its neighbors, not from anywhere else, its immediate neighbors. Okay, and since this is true for all sites that they can only topple again when all their neighbors have toppled, then you see you get into this situation. So what that means is that the avalanches are compact objects. That's the first thing. They can't have holes in them. All right, because let's say you had a hole. That meant that around you, you didn't topple, but around you, everybody did. So let's say, so if it just a site one toppled, then all 4 sites toppled, then it had to topple again. Okay, that's the basic argument. And in fact, because of the abelian structure, you get this kind of, the way that the avalanches look like is as follows. So you've got this domain out here where all the sites toppled once. And inside of that, you've got another closed domain where all the sites toppled twice. And inside of that, you've got all the sites where each where they topple three times, and so on and so on and so on. And all of these domains are closed domains contained inside of the previous one. And because of the abelian property, you can actually construct the waves explicitly as follows. So what you do is, instead of doing the dynamics that I just told you, that you just topple all sites in parallel, what you do is you don't allow the site where you added the grain to topple a second time until everybody else is done toppling. Okay? And then it doesn't matter how many grains it has. And then when everybody else is done toppling, you let it topple again if it's over the critical slope. If it's not, you don't do anything. And then you do that again, so you don't let it topple again until everyone is done toppling. And so you can get these sequences of waves explicitly constructed for you by this procedure. So there is actually some mathematical work that has been done by Dar and his collaborators, as well as some others, which I'll just very briefly mention. So they were able to construct an operator algebra for this model. So and in a general formalism, if you have a zi which is larger than its the critical value at I, then you adjust all of the z's in the system according to this rule. So delta II is how much sand you lose when you topple the site I, and delta IJ is how much sand you get at site J if you topple at site I. Now, I was discussing a nearest neighbor model on a square lattice, but one can, in general, deal with any delta IJ matrix that you like. And the abelian property is generally true. So there's some conditions on what these delta I's are, which I won't go into. I just want to give you an idea. And then briefly explain how you get the operator algebra, at least give you an idea. So you have a stable configuration C, that means none of the z's are over its critical value, and you define an operator AI, which corresponds to adding a grain to site I. And so the configuration that you get after adding a grain to site I in configuration C is C prime. And the point is that the operation of the order in which operations of these particle additions and site topplings does not matter. So in this algebra, you have that doing A, adding a site, a grain at site J, and then adding a grain at site I is the same as the first adding a site I and then a site J. And one can give a proof of this sort of thing, of this relation. And so basically the proof is here. If you have two unstable sites, I and J, this is not the same as I and J here now. If we topple at I first, this can only increase the value of the variable at site J, and this site therefore remains unstable as it was before. And after toppling at J also, the height at any site K as a result of these two topplings will undergo this change, which is independent of the order. And clearly you can do first topple at J and then at I, and you get the same result. So you don't destroy unstable sites by toppling other sites. That's the basic point. Okay. And using this operator algebra, he was able to get a number of exact results for the stationary properties. So he was able to show that the average number of topplings at site K from adding a grain at site I has got this form, where R is IK is the distance between the two sites. He was able to show that the number of the, so you can actually count the number of configurations on the attractor that the system reaches. Let me just briefly explain that, what the attractor is and what the transient states are. So let's say you start with an empty system. you can actually prove that the empty system is not only a tractor, it's just a transient state that you will never come back to, even if you start there. You will never reach it from any other state. So this is the empty state, and you can only leave that. And then you will go into some other state, depending on where you added a grain, so you can go into sort of many other states, okay? But eventually, by just keep adding grains, you will hit the set of recurrent configurations, which you can always come back to. So these have got arrows going into them, as well as arrows going out of them. Now this one might have, okay, so I think then that's sort of pretty clear what I mean. The point is that you can prove whether or not a state is on the tractor by a burning algorithm, which means that you burn all sites whose height is larger, whose z value is larger than a certain value, depending on how many neighbors that they have that aren't yet burned. And from that, you can map the set of stable configurations onto the set of spanning trees. And this then leads to a number of mathematical results. And one related result is that the number of spanning trees, or the number of states on the attractor of the system, is just the determinant of this matrix delta that I used before.
What do you mean by burn?
What I mean by burn is that you just remove it from the system.
Oh.
And then you see if you end up with an empty state or not. Okay? And if you end up with an empty state, then it's on the attractor. And if you don't end up with an empty state, it's not on the attractor. So the point is that from the properties of the attractor, using his operator algebra, he was able to get a number of analytic results, a number of states on the attractor, mapping, getting results from conformal field theory, associated with spanning trees, and this kind of propagator for sand. And as I mentioned earlier, there have been some exact results using this operator algebra for the statistics of individual waves. Yeah?
On the previous slide, you had D, which I suppose is the dimension of the system. Is that this that's like the fractal dimension of the lattice, or is that the...
That's the dimension of the system.
Okay.
Yeah. It's a log. See, look, this is a log in D equal to 2, okay?
So it's like the minimal embedding dimension?
No, I'm sorry. Yeah. So I showed you when I drew this ETW model on a lattice, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So this is a two-dimensional system, right? So I had each set I here. So this is D equal to 2, right? So I could also just do the same thing where on a one-dimensional lattice, okay? I could put my Zs here, okay? And then I can put Z critical equal to 2, and then when I topple, I just transfer one grain to each of my neighbors, something like that, right? So you can study this kind of model in any dimension.
Right.
Yeah, and so that D is the dimension of the model of the system. Okay. Of the sand, it's the dimension of the sand pile. It's got nothing to do with the dimension of the attractor. Not necessarily. Okay. Yeah.
And I guess the big L is the size of the system. Right?
The big L is absolutely the size of the system. Yeah. That's right.
Can you repeat the definition of the tractor?
Yeah. So that was probably not very clear. They're the set of recurrent states.
Just the set of.
Right.
But when you draw it like that, that's just a tree and the lattice. It doesn't give the height of each one.
No. Yeah. So the relation between this. So only. Only sites on the attractor will burn, and then there is a correspondence between how it burns and this spanning tree. So this is not a direct representation of any state on the attractor. It's a representation of how the state burns under the burning algorithm.
So there's no simple way of saying what the attractor is doing. How the correspondence between?
And I don't think so. No, I don't think it's simple at all. And I think that that's part of the problem. In fact, yeah.
Are all the recurrent states connected?
That has actually not been completely. You cannot actually prove that there's only one attractor. Is that right?
It's
a. Last time I heard Dar talk about it. Okay. Yes, I mean, according to a physicist, it's just ergodic, but I think that the state of the proof of that is not completely up to, yeah. So that's at least the folklore is that there's only one attack, yeah.
What do you mean by ergodic? I thought ergodic would mean to visit every site.
Well, look, I mean, you could imagine a situation where you have two sets of recurrent states. You've got this set of recurrent states and that, and you get to this one starting with some initial conditions, and you get to that one starting with, like, a different set of initial conditions. But that doesn't appear to be the case at all for the BTW model. I'm just making a point that I have seen GAR pressed by mathematicians on this, and the mathematicians at least don't believe that you can prove that there's only one attractor. So, yeah. I myself don't know the details of that. So, so there is some fairly well-developed mathematical theory for this model, but in spite of its simplicity and this operator alpha associated with this Boolean property, one can still not calculate the things that one is perhaps really interested in, which is the properties of these avalanches, how many topplings are in each avalanche. So S is just the number of topplings in each avalanche, and so the only thing we can do is numerical simulations. And if you do that, you can measure the statistics for these avalanches, and you get the probability to have an avalanche of size S, and you can study a whole bunch of different sand piles, and you get different universality classes depending on the model. And then this curve here is for the BTW model. And it's not entirely clear that it's a power law. There's like a big debate about that. But let's just say that it is. And so then this exponent is around 1 to 1.1. And presently, there's no way to calculate that. One can also try to figure out what are, for instance, the scaling relations. So you have an avalanche which covers a certain area. And it has a certain A, and it's got a certain, it's got these waves on top of it, so it's got a certain number of topplings S, which is not the same as A. And there's a non-trivial relation between the number of topplings and the area. So you can try to measure the, if you fix the area and you measure the average size of avalanches for a given area, then here in the circles for the BCW model, then you can try, you can find some kind of a scaling relation between size and area. And similarly, you can see, according to this parallel update where you topple all unstable sites at the same time, then that gives you a natural definition of time. And you can see that what kind of time do you get for a given area. And that defines another kind of a dynamical exponent. And so if you were to be able to make a theory of avalanches in this model, this is sort of the minimum of what one would expect to be able to calculate. But so far, no one has been able to do that. Now, so you might think, well, gee, this is really just a toy model. No one would ever take it seriously. But in fact, this is not true. Lots of people have taken it very seriously. In fact, I find it a little bit surprising. So, but that's because there really isn't any other up to then. I mean, there really wasn't any other way of trying, of any other model that one could even start to compare the statistics of with the kinds of observations that people have when they look, for instance, at the sun, or when they, you've talked to these nuclear physicists, when they look at their reconnection events and their magnetically confined plasmas. So there's been a lot of interest, particularly in that community, in this particular model, the BTW model. And there's been, for instance, a very big discussion about whether the turbulence that you see in the on the sun is soft or is different from soft, self-organized criticality. And so it was noted, for instance, that these flares, these bursts of emissions that you get from the sun have similar statistics to the BTW model. So this really intrigued a lot of people. And so they just people started looking further into it. And one issue that came up was, well, what about the waiting times between events? So if you got, you might have, I'll show this again later, but you will have some kind of a burst, and then it'll go below threshold, and another burst, so you can look at the times between consecutive bursts. And if you look at the flare data, you get, in fact, what's shown here, the log of the laminar time or the quiet time between the burst versus the log of the time, you get at least at large times a power law. And then this observation was actually used to argue that, well, the sun in a self-organized critical state, even though we see avalanches, because the waiting time statistics are not right. Because, well, you can see from the BTW model, so this has been now discussed for a long time, but just try to make it completely clear that any time you hit a site with z equal to 3, you will start an avalanche. But sometimes you don't hit a site with z equal to 3. You'll hit a site with z equal to 0, z equal to 1, z equal to 2, and you won't start an avalanche. So therefore, the waiting, the times between starting an avalanche, the process of starting an avalanche, the Poisson process, depending on whether or not you happen to hit a site with z equal to 3, and then you get an exponential distribution of times, you know, between these events, or the avalanches in the BTW model, and that's what's shown here. This is the distribution of waiting times for the BTW model. Okay, and so you can say, well, is that actually correct or not? So this is, you have to realize that there's no microscopic physical connection, of course, between what's going on in the BTW model and the reconnection processes involved in magnetohydrodynamic systems. But still, you might think that this kind of breakdown process may describe the large-scale statistical features of reconnection. And in fact, the people who have, for instance, looked at these flare data, they compared with sand piles, and they also compared with you know, MHD simulations, or in particular what's called reduced MHD simulations. So these are simulations of a turbulent kind of system. And so this argument about whether, for instance, the sun or these fusion reactors that people are building are in a self-organized critical state has now been going on for a long time, and this has been sort of the fundamental point that it can't be solved because of these waiting times. So I'll tell you about, you might think that, well, since this model was was first devised, you know, 20 years ago, all such minor points would have been straightened out a long time ago, but that's not true. So I'll just tell you a little story about something that I did quite recently on this model, quite to my surprise. So the point that we wanted to make was that we should use the same analysis technique for all models. In particular, you shouldn't allow yourself to detect bursts that are very small in the BTW model, since you can't detect very small bursts in nature. If you look at the sun, if you've got very small bursts, you would never know whether or not they're happening. You can only detect bursts that go above at least your instrumental resolution, and that is not the resolution of the smallest burst, for sure, that's happening on the sun. Okay, so you must impose, since you have to impose a threshold when you look at observations, or those thresholds are imposed on you, you should also do the same for the model. The second point is that you should use the same plot to measure durations and quiet times. That's kind of a technical point that was perhaps missed in the literature. And the last point is that since we're imposing this threshold, we want to look for universal properties that are independent of precisely where we put the threshold. So we're not going to argue about which is the right threshold to choose. What we want to do instead is measure distributions at different thresholds and see if we can rescale the distributions such that the threshold disappears from the problem, and we find universal properties. So in fact, we just compared. So we now is we can make a direct comparison between solar flare kind emission and BTW toplings. So you have this GOES data, have a temporal resolution of 1 minute, and one can impose some threshold above instrument resolution and call everything above that threshold a burst, and then everything below that threshold a quiet time, and then you get your next burst, and so on. So you can look for a given threshold, what are the statistics of the durations, and what are the statistics of the quiet times between the bursts. And then, of course, you can change your threshold. So let's say, so when we have a threshold here, we see that we just have one burst. But if we were to move the threshold up here, now we would have two bursts. We would have this burst, and then we'd have a quiet time, and then we would have that burst. And then if we increase the threshold even further, we would be back to just having one burst, but now it would be very short. So you can see that by changing the threshold of these, where you observe these intermittent time series, these bursts are not in any trivial way related to each other. Okay. Now we want to do the same thing with the BTW model. We just add frames at a certain rate, and we impose a threshold. So we just measure the number of sites toppling at any given time, and if that number is higher than a certain value, we call that a burst, and we have quiet times between them. So we don't just detect, we don't define our burst as the zero threshold avalanches, which is the way that it was done in the past, always, without question. We say that if we have any noise, let's say someone does a simulation of the BTW model, but then they send it to someone in China, and they've corrupted the signal so that each there's an error in the last few bits. So there's some noise in the signal. So how would you look at the statistics of that system? You would do that by imposing a threshold that was above your noise and looking at the statistics for events above that threshold, and then it would be much less sensitive to the noise, at least for long time scales. And in fact, if you do that to the BTW model, if you just change the threshold at which you look at the system, so these black circles are the zero threshold avalanches, and this system size here is 512. So if you measure the quiet time, the time between bursts for a given threshold, if your threshold is at zero, you just get this more or less exponential distribution. But once you increase your threshold a bit, you start to open up this power law machine. And this machine gets broader and broader if you look at a bigger system size. So this data set up here is for 2048, and this is for 512. So it appears to be a sort of a robust feature of the system. And in fact, then, you can go and compare the durations and the quiet times that you see in this model to the statistics that you see for flares. And we did this. This is the statistics of burst durations at different thresholds. And now you have this problem that you have time in the BTW model, just one sweep time. But time, how are you going to compare that to time from the data? But as I mentioned before, the data has got a temporal resolution of 1 minute. So they're averaging the flux over 1 minute. And so we can say that one minute is their resolution and one sweep time is our resolution. That seems like a pretty honest thing to do. We don't apply any fit. So if we just set one sweep time, which is our resolution, equal to 1 minute, which is the GO's resolution, then we can compare the black curves, which are I changed notation from NC to theta, but it doesn't matter. So the black curves are the model for the BT, the data for the BTW model, and the color curves are the data for the flares. Now, these are not precisely the same distributions, and one would not expect them to be, but nevertheless, it shows that this kind of model can give you at least a way of starting to describe the statistics of events. And in fact, you could also do this not only for the first durations, but also for the quiet times. And you get, you know, relatively good agreement. It's not a precise agreement. Here, you've got to rescale the quiet time at a given threshold by its average so that you have a dimensionless quantity here. And you have to multiply the probability to have a quiet time by the average time to have a dimensionless quantity here. And you can get reasonably good agreement. Yeah?
Now, how does the time resolution relate to the time, the length of time when you're adding your
that's one time step.
Okay, so you're adding one every time step?
No. So that's the driving rate. So we're adding like once every 100 time steps, but we could also add at once every 1,000 time steps if we or something else.
Really affect
the well, you could get this up. Then you have to, at some point, everything, if you add very, very fast, for a given system size, eventually the activity will get smooth. You won't see any peaks in the system because the whole thing is toppling. Everything's toppling all the time. Okay.
Right.
So as long as you're in a regime where you can see bursts, this is pretty much invariant. These statistics are coming from the properties of single avalanches. They're not coming from, because of the abelian property, you know this, right? They're not coming from any interference effect between avalanches. So you could just take a single long avalanche and put a threshold in it and measure the quiet times between the local peaks, and you would get exactly the same statistics that I just showed you. Okay, so I don't know whether I should continue or not. How much?
Well, 7 minutes.
7 minutes. Okay, so now I told the story about the BTW model. So it has it's had a very big impact on how people think about these sorts of systems. There have been some mathematical approaches to try to deal with it. And there have been attempts, I should say, to make modifications or slightly different types of models to maybe more accurately describe the flaring system, or there are other types of models to describe earthquakes. In fact, there are, I would say, roughly about 10 interesting models out there in the literature, and then lots of variations of those models. So since we don't really have a very well-developed mathematics at this point for dealing with these sorts of systems, we don't actually, it's a bit, let's say, unconventional from the traditional physics point of view. We don't go to the blackboard or to our notebooks and start writing down lots of equations because we don't know what equations to write down. Okay, this is a big problem, and it's been a long-standing problem in non-equilibrium systems. But these sorts of models, these sort of very simple models, gives us a way of conceptualizing the problem and of testing our ideas via computer simulations. And we try to just put the basic ingredients that are what we think are really important for the process that's going on, sort of to try to make a distilled representation of the process. And we see if we get anything interesting that can be compared to natural phenomena. So I think what I'll do is I'll just mention that this is what I'll do actually is I'll point to stop and not go into this because it's kind of a long discussion. But this is going to be the starting point of my next talk, this forest fire model as a toy model for turbulence and comparison between the statistics that one observes for fires in this model with the statistics, for instance, of luminous matter in the universe and other consequences of that. Thanks a lot.
Are there any questions?
Is there a predictive component to establishing a valid comparison between the sand pile model and the solar flares? Or is it merely, and what way?
Merely,
there's a phenomenological comparison there, and I'm wondering, does it also imply a predictive component that you would be able to understand something about the mechanisms for solar flares, or maybe some of the assumptions of the sand pile model would be likely to be properties of the underlying mechanisms for solar flares, that kind of thing?
Well, prediction in science is a complicated word. In fact, it means many different things to different people. So I would say that you have a predictive model if you can observe something in your model, some statistical feature of a system, say, which is, and then you can say, I expect to observe that feature in such and such a system, and then go out and measure that, or reanalyze previous measurements and get quantitative agreement. Would you agree with that? Would that constitute a prediction for you?
Well, I wasn't sure if I followed what you were saying. Is there something about the solar flare flare properties other than the existing observations, like the statistics that you to think they would match?
I actually have worked quite a lot on this problem with a different kind of a model. Let me just briefly, I think I deleted the, sorry. Yeah, so if you go to this picture here, right, you've got magnetic fields, the white regions coming out of the sun, and the magnetic fields, the black regions going into the sun. And if you look at small scales, you can sort of blow this up and you can get fine resolution down to one arc second. which is about 100 kilometers. And then you can measure the sizes of the regions of flux going out and the sizes of regions of flux going in, and you can make it, measure the distribution of these sizes. And this was always predicted to be an exponential distribution, and it was always, for that reason, plotted on a log linear scale, because it was believed that there was a characteristic scale for these things. And we made a different kind of a model than the sandpile model, which has the geometry of magnetic fields and includes this physical process of reconnection, which is a highly nonlinear threshold process. So in that sense, the BTW model shares this strong local nonlinearity, which can trigger other kinds of discharge events. But it doesn't capture the geometry of the field. So we made a little model that looks like this, where you've got loops, and I don't want to go into that, okay? And let me just tell you, so what you mean by prediction. So this model was made before the data was obtained and analyzed. So this is actually the positive and negative fragments of flux from the surface of the sun on a log-log scale. It had never been plotted on a log-log scale before. We just wrote to the astrophysicists and got their data. And this is results from numerical simulations of our model, this loop model. So this thing is just a finite size effect. We can move it to the left or right by changing the system size. And the only thing that's done here is we have to set one loop equal, which is our resolution, equal to the resolution of the measurement, which is about 10 to the 17 Maxwell. So that's sort of lining up this point. And so we predicted from the model that you would observe this power law distribution. We analyzed the data, and it was found to be so, and that had not been known before. So right. In that sense, I believe that these are actually as predictive models as anything else in physics.
So if the solar flares are completely independent, then you would get 5 times that were plus all the about.
Absolutely, yeah.
But in fact, there's some degree of correlation between that piece.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly, yeah.
Okay, mm-hmm. Okay, question, Doug?
I was just having a question about this sand pile model. Yeah. If you think about it, it's rather physical. Now, I don't want to criticize it because I understand you calculate what you can calculate and what you can't leave alone. But physically, you would like to have a model where the avalanche occurs depending on the difference in height. Neighboring site also has just as many.
So those models. Yes, there are. And those models have actually, there are several of them. Okay? You can make, they're called the critical slope model. Yeah? And you get very similar types of behavior. You get different critical, you know, the exponents are different. And those models in detail have been compared with avalanche experiments in what are called rice piles. So you take these two, you take a table and you take two clear plates and you put them relatively close to each other. And you put a wall over here and you add rice over here and it comes out over here. And then they take pictures with a CCD camera. And then they measure the changes in the potential energy of the rice pile every, I don't know, 5 seconds or something like that. And then you measure the histogram of these avalanches, yeah, and you get a power law distribution, and you can compare that in detail with models where, in this case, you don't want the critical height to be fixed because depending on the geometry of the rice grains and how they are, you can sometimes support a higher critical slope locally than at other times, and so you can make this critical slope a random variable, and if you do that, well, you can get models which sort of agree with experiments. I mean, the problem in many cases is that these experiments, it's much easier in some sense to observe natural phenomena because these experiments require a huge range of space and time scales. It's the same problem with equilibrium critical phenomena. But there you've got, you know, you can use X-ray sources, you know, to look at things, but nobody has sort of gotten around, well, I don't think anyone yet has gotten around to putting these things into synchrotron systems. So, the level of experiment is, let's say, it's still at the tabletop level. So the quality of the results maybe are not sufficient to distinguish completely these different models. But yes, there's a nice, very nice literature by especially the Norwegian group, but the Fager's group, on that problem exactly.
Yeah, you started off by making a comparison with statistical mechanics and critical phenomena there.
Yeah.
And then you mentioned the universality that people talk about.
Right.
It's related to the existence of some sort of simple order parameters.
Like yeah.
Or order parameters. So like a scalar field or something like
yeah,
that,
right.
You can write down some effective
yeah, that's true.
Hamiltonian for that scalar field and analyze and see why different systems.
Yeah, that's
is there some analog of that?
Well,
parameter and so on effective parameter.
Yes, but not nearly at the same level. Okay, there are in certain particular cases, let's say mappings. Exact map like you have between the Einstein model and the lattice gas say, right? You know, so you can just map directly one model to the other. So there are these mappings, for instance, in models of self-organized criticality between, in fact, these sort of rice pile models and models of interface depending, as well as some earthquake models. At least in one dimension, one can make exact mappings. And in that case, you can prove that you have universality between models that appear very different, okay? To a mathematical construction, you can map. However, that's not what you were talking about. I know this. So the answer is that there is no formal proof, and one would generally expect that we know this in equilibrium, that the dynamical universality classes are much smaller, let's say, than the static ones, so one would expect not so broad. But nevertheless, I think that the idea is that if you have scaling behavior, that it can't be that all of these microscopic degrees of freedom are important, that there are only some that can possibly survive at large scales. And the other fact of the matter is that if that's not the case, we can't really do anything as physicists anyhow, right? So that in some sense is kind of a hope. And it does appear to be confirmed in the sense that with relatively simple models, you can actually, as I just showed for this data, and to the extent that you cannot rule out that this model is the right description of that data, if you make better data, then maybe eventually you can rule this out, and then I would argue we could go back to the model and figure out what we needed to add in order to get the right statistics.
But there's no suggestion for what these macroscopic variables might be.
That's true. I really...
That seems like the next...
The thing is I happen not to believe that there is any ensemble formulation. So I think one has got to sort of come to grips really with the dynamics of these systems, because they're self-organizing systems.
Well, I'm not saying it's in equilibrium.
Yeah, but well...
Something like the scalar field or...
It's not very... just to be completely straight about it, this is something that has not happened.
Any more questions?
Going back to the question of predictability, can you not use this model to predict the solar weather? Can you not look at the solar data for one and say there's a probability of 50% of
okay.
solar flares
like actually, the sun is a kind of a bad example. I'll tell you why. Okay, so the flare, the one of the things that we learn from the model, and in fact that you observe in the corona, is that the lifetime of the flux structures in the corona is less than a day. Okay, so the corona, where the flares come from, forget everything in less than a day. So when you're looking at really long time correlations, then what you're talking about is the process of bringing the flux from beneath the photosphere into the corona, which is this magnetic dynamo in the convective region below the photosphere, which has got not very well understood, and it's got its own dynamics. But I think that, yes, in principle, one could make a model of that thing, and one could get an idea of what kind of correlations there are, and in that sense, use it for prediction. But I think that's quite far off.
Yeah, so perhaps the last question.
I think you partly answered this already in discussing the rice piles.
Yeah.
But my question is basically before we jump to the sun, how well can our sand pile model actually reproduce the behavior of sand piles?
Okay, so that's a good question. So I mentioned that there have been these nice experiments on these rice piles, okay, where, and then there have been models constructed to sort of describe the rice piles. Maybe they're not exactly the same universality class, okay, but they get all the same kind of features and appear similar. Now, if the point is that it depends actually on the aspect ratio of the grains. So if you use round sand, you don't see this avalanches of all. I mean, you use relatively round rice, then you don't see the avalanches of all sizes. It's only when you have elongated grains, which are most grains, in fact, are. So, I mean, like easily, my son has been running around in lots of rice piles with messing them up. But I mean, it's not just the Norwegian group that's doing it, but they're also doing it in Amsterdam, for instance. And actually, the biggest problem with experiments is mice. But anyhow, if you use sand, you sort of run into this problem of that of inertial effects, that the sand just starts rolling and you don't get avalanches of all sizes. You have to have enough friction really in the system. Yeah. So it depends. You don't always get this. I don't want to imply that. But you can actually, you can go and look at nature, and there have been lots of papers, written on this. You definitely do get this in granular systems.
Cool.
Yeah.
Okay. Any more questions? There's some here.
The sand pile model and the avalanche model, I was just thinking did you have the force of gravity as a trigger for this self-organization? And if so, like in terms of theory, like could you incorporate some gravity into this model?
Yeah, you could do that. I think that's a reasonable thing to do. I mean, if you really wanted to make in detail a model of the rice pile, you would have to make a model where you had these contacts and this kind of contact structure, and then you would obviously have gravity in the problem, and you would solve, the equations of motion with some static friction. And people, I mean, in principle, want to do such a thing. I'm not sure if that's actually been done. Instead, what people have done, I can just write down, this is a rather famous model. So you've got size I, and you have H at size I, and here everything would fall off, and you add here, and so you get sort of configurations that say like that. And so if your slope here, so H I minus H I plus 1 is greater than some eta I of the number of times that you topple there, which is a random variable, then one grain of sand, falls down, right? That's the kind of model that you use. And you have fluctuations in the local slope that you can tolerate depending on the local configurations of the rice grains. So sometimes if they're, depending on how they're aligned with each other, they actually tend to align sort of in the same way if you go and look at it. You can tolerate a much higher slope than at other times. So these kinds of models can be studied, and in fact, you can actually, this is the kind of model that you can map, as I mentioned, to interface depinning and lots of other problems.
Thank you very much. Since we are a bit running out of time, I will ask all other people to ask questions in private. Maya, there's our friend Maya. Okay. Yeah. So just next week we'll have a talk by Peter Drudwager, can one measure complexity? So this same time, same room. And if you would like to get some posters and post it somewhere around that, we can do it. So could you do it in this week?
Yeah.
Okay. So one and three. See you next week.
Yeah. Thank you. So why don't you send me your email? I just get it.